You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking to investigative journalist Tom Mueller about his book, How to Make a Killing, Blood, Death, and Dollars in American Medicine. We're focusing on the dialysis industry, but in a sense, this book really is kind of a case study of how American medicine has gone off the rails. And so, Tom, you know, we're talking about dialysis, and you know, let's clarify what are some of the different options for dialysis, because there's fast and slow, and there's also home dialysis. There's peritoneal dialysis, which is usually done in hospital for emergencies. That's not practical for people on a routine basis. And then there's the option of getting a transplant, which has kind of entered the picture as well, and kind of gives people an off-ramp from the need to go in three times a week and spend hours and hours and hours sitting on a table, sometimes with a painful catheter in their arms, getting dialyzed.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are a number of different options. And the number one option and one of the key things to target in making sure that our incidence of dialysis reduces as rapidly as possible to zero, which is the end game. Keep people on their kidneys or keep people on other people's kidneys who don't need them anymore. Transplant is the absolute gold standard of how to deal with this. Our kidneys are miraculous, and they have a million little nephrons that are working away. They do 24/7 what these cumbersome machines, which require a complete rework of your life. You know, our kidneys really are doing everything that we need, and to keep people on their kidneys by both preventative medicine, by the use of these new, you know, Ozempic and Wegovy and other marketed as weight loss medications, but actually all semi-miraculous from the point of view of kidney health, using those to keep people on off of dialysis in the first place.
Right. I think it was a study about something called CKD, which is hereditary kidney disease, polycystic kidney disease, and that patients who received these weight loss drugs could delay dialysis. I think that was the connection there, is this whole notion that, you know, maybe we should be focusing more of our efforts on preventing people going down the rabbit hole towards this.
Precisely. And as you pointed out earlier, Dr. Hoffman, the underlying diabetes, hypertension, and obesity epidemics that we're dealing with really are the drivers of much of dialysis. So there are genetic predispositions. There are genetic illnesses that do cause kidney failure. And for those people, unfortunately, we will need dialysis forever. But as far as I know, forever is a long time. But yeah, I transplant is absolutely the gold standard. We need to revamp, and that's revamp our transplantation system. It's not efficient, and a lot of people die while waiting for organs. As you pointed out, there are two different main kinds of dialysis: peritoneal dialysis, which fills the peritoneum with a dialysate with a liquid and uses the peritoneum as a filter for the blood. And that's a very, very different proposition from hemodialysis, which is what 90% plus of American patients have, which is actually connecting your blood vessels, your blood supply to the machine and taking all of your blood out of your body into the machine and around in a circuit. So those two you know, peritoneal dialysis actually is quite viable for home use. And the main reason I think that hemodialysis is preferred is precisely because the business model of the major, the dominant corporations, and this goes back decades, is about hemodialysis in center. And that's why we do mainly hemodialysis in center. Not because it's
so
better.
So home dialysis is by definition peritoneal dialysis. People are
either or. Okay. Either peritoneal or, and both are extremely viable in a sense. Peritoneal dialysis is actually simpler to do at home. Neither is simple. Both are involved and require a fair bit of expertise, but people can be trained to do this. And the reason, you know, there's a kind of a learned helplessness about the American patient that is not shared by many patients in many other countries. Huh. You're encouraged to take as much of the burden of your chronic disease. And this goes for kidney failure, but other chronic disease as well. One of the key things to keeping people mentally and physically well is to engage them in their disease and make them feel that they are taking action against it and not sitting there and saying, as one patient told me, his caregivers told him, just give me your arm. I just want your blood.
Yeah.
You know, sit down, shut up and move on. So yeah, the home dialysis is the answer. Absolutely. And again, Congress back in the 70s, that's what they signed on for, primarily home dialysis. What they got was a slightly different system, cattle call dialysis, as some people have called it, or Jiffy Lube dialysis, in center, fast and quick, very profitable for two major corporations, but not necessarily what's best for patients.
So you've been around the world. You've lived in 28 countries. You're a Rhodes Scholar. You've seen systems elsewhere. We're actually talking to you from overseas. You're in Italy right now as we interview you. Have you seen other countries providing a better quality of care and innovation in the field of dialysis?
I certainly have. I mean, you'd have to go far to find a country that does worse than America, frankly. I mean, you know, the idea that for-profit entities would be the major providers of care is impossible. And many of the developed countries, you know, that you deal with throughout the EU, but also Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the UK. I mean, this is just not, you know, that's not their territory. And so when they hear about some of the disruptions, dysfunctions, or perverse incentives that are created by an aggressively for-profit medical system, and specifically dialysis, they at first don't believe it. They're like, nah, that can't be. Are you serious? Do they really do this? I mean, one German nephrologist said to me, well, I think by law, in Germany, they can only have 20, maybe 30, but 20, I think, patients max. The nephrologist is only allowed to have that number of patients, no more. Wow. And I have met and talked with eminent nephrologists who almost brag about having hundreds of patients. And right. Well, how do you really follow their care day to day? How do you tailor their care? We just go through and someone jokingly called it wave dialysis, wave rounds. You do wave rounds. You walk by and you wave as you go by.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not funny to a lot of people. It's certainly not funny to MDs abroad. You know, in Italy, I had two things. One home dialysis patient that I knew quite well, and she's still going strong. And another who lived, she has passed away, but she was 86 years old when she passed away. Three times a week, the ambulance would arrive. The two hefty guys would go to the top floor, take her down, and she'd be chatting away with them as they went down the stairs, off to the hospital for 4 or 5 hours of treatment. Back upstairs, and this went on. I mean, again, she was on dialysis for decades, and that's the sort of thing that once upon a time in America happened. People were on dialysis for decades, but nowadays, I mean, you know, 4 or 5 years, that's about when most people, the average life expectancy is 5 years, and that's, you know, that's gotten, you know, that is unacceptable by developed world standards.
It takes a toll on you. There's also, and we have to really introduce this concept because, you know, there's big buzz about racism in medicine these days, but I think there's no clearer example than the treatment of end-stage renal disease patients because, unfortunately, there's a predominance among minorities of end-stage renal disease. So the rates of African-American hypertension are sky high. Diabetes is rampant in some communities. And so we see kind of a marginalization of patients who are poor and minorities getting this kind of treatment. And they really are sort of second or third class citizens when it comes to dialysis. There's a great differential between people who have private insurance, who are more lucrative for these companies, than patients where the reimbursement is kind of meager because of its government insurance.
Yeah, dialysis in America is a poster child for structural racism in American medicine, unfortunately. I mean, your likelihood, if you're a Black American, of having kidney failure in the first place is almost four times what it is for whites. It's significantly higher if you're Hispanic or Native American or a Pacific Islander. And that's having to do to a small degree with genetics in the Black American population, but largely to do with their environment. And you know, that dialysis deserts is a term that I've encountered in several places, playing on the food deserts, but, you know, places where people are going to end up generationally in that gray, shiny chair sooner or later. And they're worried that their kids are going to be there. The waiting rooms of the dialysis facilities are full of kids who are waiting for their parents or their grandparents. It is a generational disaster. And I have run into cases, nephrologists saying that people suggesting that people, particularly Black Americans, are being put on dialysis in some areas sooner than they need to be, based on very simplistic measurements of creatinine, rather than a full body picture. You mentioned another very important point, Dr. Hoffman.
Let's double click on that. There is, in some cases, and you point this out in the book, a rush to dialysis that's inappropriate because it's actually more lucrative than good quality medical care that can forestall dialysis for years. And it's more labor intensive to keep a patient off dialysis than to simply put them on the assembly line.
Exactly. I mean, first of all, we should be talking about the GLP-1 agonists and the SGLT2 inhibitors and the other, you know, miracle drugs that should be keeping people off dialysis in the first place. But the notion that in some sense, the default for someone who has a declining kidney function and reaches, you know, the magic number of eGFR of an estimated
glomerular filtration rate. I paid the big bucks to go to medical school, so I'm entitled to pronounce it.
You can see that I didn't. I never claimed to have any serious medical training, but glomerular filtration rate of 15 or whatever the cutoff is. And all of a sudden, okay, next step is dialysis, without saying, here are your options, or how old are you and how rapidly is this progressing? Mm-hmm. The key number here is not the X, it's the FX. It's the how rapidly your change, you're degrading.
Rate of change.
Unfortunately, those questions are quite often not answered. There's also a big problem of hospital emergency rooms and hospital facilities capturing patients who have some level of kidney failure and then funneling them into facilities of dialysis corporations. These are all things that really need to have a hard look. We really need to think why people are going on dialysis in the first place, and can we avoid it, mitigate it, and above all, prevent people from what they call crashing into dialysis. We've talked about how few Americans know that they have any problem with their kidneys. Well, 60% of people who go on to dialysis are shocked. I mean, crash into dialysis. One day, you know, they're going along with their normal lives, and maybe they're feeling a little tired. All of a sudden, they wake up in the emergency room with no kidneys. And this is just no way to manage kidney health in America. It's causing, and it costs $150 billion to this nation every year in private and public insurance. Medicare alone, somewhere on the order of $34 billion is spent on dialysis. This is non-sustainable. We got to fix this. The other issue that you brought up is the distinction between public and private insurance patients. Now, the dialysis companies will deny this, and they have their data. I have laid out my data in my book, and my data says that there is a significant two-class system. Second-class citizens are Medicare and Medicaid patients who ultimately are not nearly as profitable of a factor of 3 to 10 times as privately insured patients. So privately insured patients get the red carpet treatment. They get the shifts that they want, the golden shifts. And the publicly insured patients are also RANs. And unfortunately, according to my reporting, the publicly insured patients who raise a hand and question the quality of their care may, in some cases, be involuntarily discharged from their facilities.
Wow. Just kicked out.
Kicked out. Yeah. It's called lemon dropping and cherry picking. And it's sort of, you know, those two things. And you know, I won't say that there isn't a patient out there that threatens violence or is abusive or whatever. However, on one hand, no other country that I've encountered ever, this is one of those where foreign nephrologists say, nah, come on, really? And I say, well, look, here are the numbers. Here are the stories. But it's also in a high pressure, high speed environment where there are a lot of sick people whose treatment itself is making them sick. I mean, when you do bazooka dialysis, you feel terrible. The workers are overworked. So this is a train wreck waiting to happen. This is a personal clash between dialysis patients and providers. It's just built into the system. But yes, I mean, involuntary discharge is a major concern. It's also a concern in certain other parts of health, in nursing homes and in specialty hospitals, private specialty hospitals for profit. Discharge is on the rise. But in dialysis, to me, there's a certain extra sinister level to discharging someone from care, and subsequently they get blackballed in the area. They aren't accepted for treatment in other area facilities, and so they end up in the ER, which is not good. They only are treated when they're a genuine emergency. In other words, when they're almost dead.
I just yelled this up while you were talking, and I think you mentioned it in the book. Civil rights complaint alleges abuse in dialysis treatment. The SEIU, that's the Service Employees International Union, have filed a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, alleging widespread health and civil rights violations at kidney dialysis centers in California. That's a case in point, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There are a number of investigations taking place. The Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights has a couple of investigations open. I'm not sure where those are going. But the fact is, it's widely recognized that it's widely recognized that the incidence of kidney failure and application of dialysis is vastly more among minority populations than it is among Caucasians.
Indeed. All right. There's kind of the mini scandal embedded within this. It centers around the use of erythropoietin, or EPO, famously used by Tour de France bicyclists like Lance Armstrong to boost their red blood cell counts. Dialysis patients with kidney failure are notoriously anemic. They have low red blood cell counts due to the fact that the kidneys make this EPO. So a drug was introduced called EPO, and it has been a real boon to the pharmaceutical company, whatever company it is that makes it. It's, you know, used very liberally in dialysis patients, but with less than desirable consequences sometimes. What's the story on that?
Yeah, it's by now it's kind of a history lesson in perverse incentives, because it's sort of the story has reached a conclusion. I mean, it started off when Amgen invented one of the first blockbuster billion-dollar, you know, biotech drugs. Yeah, erythropoietin, EPO. And it was introduced in 1989. It was used in modest quantities in dialysis and cancer care and various other areas until 1991, when Medicare changed its reimbursement policy. And essentially, in dialysis, what it did was it made every dose that you gave of EPO a profit center, because the dialysis companies could buy from Amgen and ultimately other producers.
They would buy it wholesale, and then they'd retail it in effect and charge more.
Yeah, their reimbursement rate from Medicare was higher than the cost of the drug, you know, their base cost. So they were making a profit on every dose. And I will let you guess, Dr. Hoffman, what happened to the use of EPO after 1991? It went through the roof. And you know, between 89 and 2010, Medicare spent more than $40 billion on EPO. It was the single most expensive drug in the whole formulary. And there were, unfortunately, at the same time, there were these clinical trials beginning to show, wait a second, if you give people too much EPO, their blood gets too thick. I mean, if you're a Tour de France racer, you're one thing. If you're a very sick person with kidney failure or a cancer, your blood gets too thick and you have a higher incidence of coronary arrest, of strokes, and so on. Eventually, the FDA put a black box warning on it. People, we're saying the big pharmaceutical companies, the big dialysis companies, but ultimately, at the end of the day, it's an MD who signs a prescription. It's a doctor who says, yes, this is the care that I wish to give to my patient. So while they are working for that big company and while life might be a very bumpy road for them if they push back, some doctors do push back. They say, no, we're not going to go with, this level of EPO. To make a long story short, EPO eventually got Congress's attention. They did probes and investigations and eventually decided to change the formulation. I mean, they eventually decided to change the reimbursement policy. In the meantime, there was a lot of talk from dialysis companies. No. This is standard of care. We're giving the amount of EPO that is good for our patients, full stop. In 2007, Ken Thierry, who was the former CEO and founder of DaVita, one of the big two, famously declared in a New York Times interview that he would welcome the removal of financial incentives to overprescribe EPO. He said, do that tomorrow so we get rid of the taint. We're still going to use the same amount of EPO. The fact is, when in January 2011, Medicare eliminated reimbursement for individual EPO doses and cut out that incentive to use more, in that year alone, Fresenius dropped its annual EPO usage by 29%, almost 30%, and DaVita by almost 47%.
That proves the point because, I mean, if it was really just based simply on pure medical considerations, it would have stayed level. But with the financial incentive removed, the prescribing dropped.
Absolutely. And again, there are really good uses for EPO. Thank goodness it has been invented and thank goodness it is being used. It is available, perhaps not in the way that it should be. But yeah, when you make the financial incentive, bake the financial incentives into the practice of medicine and when you allow, corporations to make their decisions purely based on financial incentives primarily and answerable to their shareholders more than to their patients, it's a recipe for disaster.
Indeed. All right. So this is a little bit of a sci-fi kind of thing, but could it be that within a few decades, we might foresee this chapter in medicine relegated to kind of the dark ages of medicine, like bloodletting and the use of arsenic for syphilis because of the sophistication of new transplantation methods? What they're doing now is they're taking animals, they're cloning them, they're GMO animals that can provide organs, basically they're growing organs in animals that can be transplanted into humans. Now, trans-species transplantation doesn't work, but a GMO animal that is genetically identical to humans and has the right whatever blood type characteristics and the right genetic characteristics, major histocompatibility complex, etc., it's actually on the horizon. I think they've just announced the first successful transplantation from an animal to a human of a GMO organ. And maybe, just maybe, in 20 or 30 years, this will become standard practice and will reduce the need for people to become kidney donors.
I think that's absolutely on the horizon. I hope it is. And as you say, I mean, we've already had a touchwood successful kidney transplant of a genetically modified pig kidney into an end-stage renal disease patient in New York at Einstein. And again, the operation appears to have gone well, and the patient appears to be doing well. It is. So potentially, yes, I think potentially there is a major breakthrough and a huge reduction in the need for dialysis. And I think also, again, these Ozempics and Wegovys and other drugs, if we can get them out of, weight loss and into a broadly prescribed kidney awareness movement. And this is another thing about kidney health. There are no sort of marches and demonstrations and big celebrities standing up and saying, for some reason, kidney disease, although
there's no blood on the steps of the FDA, as with HIV, and AIDS, right?
Perfect example. Perfect example. And no, there isn't. And somehow there's almost a stigma to it. That needs to change. But New kidney transplantation and CRISPR and GMO animals on the one hand, preventative medicine on the other. Home dialysis for those who need it no matter what, I think is critical. It is worth remembering that back in the 70s, when Congress passed this, people were already talking about xenotransplantation and the miracle of these. So before we put all our faith in that, I think we need to, you know, see how it scales. But certainly the signs are very, very promising.
So what can we do in the here and now in conclusion? You know, you've become an expert in this field and you've sort of taken up the cause of a better care for patients with end-stage renal disease. Where is the activism? Where are the congressional hearings? Where? How can people get involved?
That's a very, very good question, Dr. Hoffman. The activism needs to happen and people do need to get involved. I think, first of all, they need to realize that if they're 37 million is a lot of people and the kidneys need to be in part of our conversation. I think that, you know, ultimately we need more competition in this industry. I don't think the two firms should dominate the lives of 80% of patients. We should focus on clinical outcomes and on medical advice. In other words, home dialysis, slow, gentle, low ultrafiltration rate, and not the opposite in center. We need CMS to step up. I mean, right now, CMS is just not doing
Center
its
for
job.
Medical, what, that's the what, they set the rates basically for Medicare. Yeah.
Exactly. The payer, the part of Health and Human Services that pays out Medicare and Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And you know, their metrics for judging whether a clinic is doing a good job doesn't even mention treatment time, doesn't even mention ultrafiltration rate, doesn't even mention blood flow rate. Mm-hmm. They don't look at the water quality in a serious way, all kinds of metrics that are missing from, I mean, it's like saying, you know, that there are a bunch of people with broken legs. We're not going to look at why they broke. We're just going to, you know, put casts on. They're not looking at the underlying dynamics of what makes good dialysis. So that's key. And then we talked about these breakthrough drugs and a much better transplantation system. All these things are moving forward, but there needs to be a conversation. I think Dr. Hoffman, a national conversation about kidney care, A, and central to, you know, millions of lives. B, we're doing worse than everybody else, and we shouldn't. That's not the American way. And C, it is a microcosm of American health. If we can get this right, we'll have tools to make a lot of other improvements elsewhere in the medical world.
Well, your book, How to Make a Killing, Blood, Death, and Dollars in American Medicine, is a great contribution to the dialogue that we need to have about how to reform our medical system. And so it's much appreciated. There's a website, which is tommueller.com. And can you know, let's spell Mueller. It's M-U-E-E-L-L-E-R. Is that? Oh, .co. I'm sorry. Not .com. .co.
That's right.
Okay. That, so forget the
that's
end.
That's right. Tom Mueller. MUELLER.CO.
Okay. And it talks about the book and it talks about you and, you know, your background and, you know, great stuff. Really, I commend you on, you know, just a really well-written book. I mean, you're obviously a great writer. Your next foray is going to be into fiction because you got the chops. You know, you wrote like
critics say I've already broken that wall. But my next foray is this right now, to be honest with you. I find it very hard to think about anything else right now. Having written this, typically a writer will be, you know, already, you know, a year before their book gets published,
yeah,
will be thinking about the next project. This is my next project. Until I see some change in the dialysis industry, I'm going to stick with this.
Okay, so until then, I will bid you buona sera. Because it's getting late over there in Italy. It's early here in the United States. So enjoy your sojourn. Where are you located over there?
In Liguria, which is in far northwestern corner near the French border.
Okay. I'm sure it's really gorgeous there. And so as I gaze out on the vista of New York City's skyscrapers behind me, you know, I envy you where you're currently at. Thanks very much for joining us, Tom. It's really been a pleasure. And I encourage our listeners to get your book, How to Make a Killing, Blood, Death, and Dollars in American Medicine.
Dr. Hoffman, thank you very much for the time, and I really value conversations with medical authorities, which I am not, and I'd love to hear from listeners who have something to to say or to contribute to the conversation.
Right. And certainly, and actually, you actually have a solicitation for whistleblowers. And that's actually an important part of your book because you've interviewed a lot of patients, a lot of disenchanted clinicians and physicians, employees of some of these facilities. And that really is at the heart of the book, the actual testimonies of people who've experienced some of the downsides of our current infatuation with high-throughput, for-profit medicine. So, good stuff. Exactly. We encourage people to to step up.
My conversations with patients and with caregivers both are really the drive me to, you know, to stick with this as long as I can.
Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.